From the creative team that brings you the world and everything in it, this is the Legal Docket Podcast. If you'd like to hear these episodes before the weekend, they're released earlier in the week on the Legal Docket feed. Search for it and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts.
Oh, beautiful packaging.
Okay, so the red bar goes there. Red foil goes there.
Okay.
Lavender foil goes there. Blue foil. And then
those bars wrapped in foil, one of the world's most favorite foods, chocolate. We ate up that chocolate.
Piles of chocolate.
Not mass-produced industrial chocolate, Kraft chocolate.
This is like chocolate party in a box?
So this is from a company in Northern Virginia, where I live, and they ethically source their cocoa beans.
Ethically source their cocoa beans. No slave labor. No child labor.
Yeah.
Okay.
We followed the instructions on the chocolate tasting kit. Step one.
Okay, so let's start with this bar. Open it up. What does the chocolate bar look like?
So the packaging is beautiful. It's very inviting. It says Peru, 72% chocolate. Anticipation. It's got ocean waves on it, imprinted on it.
Step two, you're gonna break off a piece.
What does it sound like when you break it?
Very snappy.
Crisp.
Crisp, yes.
That means that the chocolate is properly in temper. I'm going to have to Google that.
Step three, smell it.
Where did it say that? Okay, notes of mocha.
Yes.
Cedar. I'm not getting the cedar. Raspberry, I get.
And then the best part.
Allow a bit of chocolate to melt slowly on the tongue and move chocolate around mouth.
Mmm. So hard not to chew.
Mmm. That is delicious.
Before tasting the second bar, we need to neutralize our taste buds.
Let's do this. All right, now you cleanse your palate with an oyster crack.
But that first chocolate bar from Peru?
So remember that taste, because supposedly, not only every region has a different taste, but every cocoa tree.
We sampled chocolate from three companies. Two small handcrafted places, Riversea Chocolates and Goodnow Farms Chocolate, and one multinational company, Tony's Chocolonely. You may have seen these bars in the grocery store. They're huge, with cartoon letters printed on colorful wrapping.
Right. So that was the fun part of this story. And now for the not-so-fun part. The reason Tony's Chocolonely was founded in the first place was because an investigative reporter from the Netherlands learned about a horrible situation, forced child labor in the cocoa industry. The reporter's name is Tuin van de Kerken, and, well, here's a TEDx talk that tells part of his story.
He bought chocolate bars from about 10, 15 companies, of which he was sure there was slavery in the value chain somewhere. And he ate each of these bars and put a camera on himself and called the police. And he said, I want to turn myself in as a chocolate criminal. Because according to Dutch law, if I know of criminal activities in a value chain and I buy something, I'm responsible.
He actually tried to get a court to prosecute him, but it didn't work. The judge dismissed him, said he'd have to arrest every Dutch person because everyone eats chocolate.
The three companies we just mentioned, and many more, are trying to change the system by sourcing beans from farms that don't use forced child labor. Our case today involves six former child laborers from Mali who also want to change the chocolate industry. The child slaves escaped the West African cocoa farms they worked. In 2005, they filed a lawsuit in the United States that included Nestle USA and Cargill, large-scale chocolate manufacturers.
Are such cases allowed to proceed? American courts didn't dismiss that question quite so easily as the Dutch. It's been tied up in litigation for 15 years. And this past summer, the United States Supreme Court weighed in.
I I, Clarence Thomas.
I, Sonia Sotomayor.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch.
I, Elena Kagan.
I, Samuel A. Alito Jr.
I, Stephen Breyer.
I, Amy Coney Barrett.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice
without respect,
to persons.
That I will support and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge
the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
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 Welcome to Legal Docket. I'm Jenny Ruff.
And I'm Mary Reichard. This podcast is from the team that brings you The World and Everything in It.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Come with us inside the world of the Supreme Court as we look more deeply into current disputes and how they make a difference to your life.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States.
Today, a case about the dark side of chocolate, children working on cocoa farms, and a legal question of corporate liability for human rights violations.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
Support for the Legal Docket podcast comes from listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, connecting Christians across the nation who care for one another spiritually and financially when a medical need arises. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
What?
Crispity, crunchity, peanut buttery.
One friend of the court brief filed in this case quoted a cocoa farm slave who had been freed. He had never even tasted chocolate. When asked what he'd say to the millions of people who eat the chocolate made from his labor, he said, "Tell them when they eat chocolate, they are eating my flesh." He's not a party to this case, but other former slaves are. Let's begin by meeting John Doe number one in our set of consolidated cases today, Nestle v. Doe and Cargill v. Doe. Doe means unnamed plaintiff, and there are six of them, although we learned the name of one man, Fusing Malay. He lives in Mali in West Africa. In this audio recording, he speaks a local dialect with an intermediary giving a voiceover in French. We'll translate the statement into English based on a transcript his lawyer gave us.
He says, "I was trafficked from my home country, Mali, at age 14 to work on a large cocoa plantation in Côte d'Ivoire. The man who recruited me told me I'd get a good-paying job harvesting cocoa. But when he arrived at the plantation, I didn't get money. I was told if I worked hard, I'd be given food. If not, I'd starve. The plantation was heavily guarded. At night, I was kept in a locked room to prevent escape."
J'ai été réduit en esclave.
He continues, "If the guards felt I wasn't working quickly enough, I was beaten with tree branches. I used a sharp machete to cut down and open the cocoa pods. I used dangerous chemicals like herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizer without any safety equipment. I finally escaped when I was 19 years old, but those days still haunt me."
Terry Collingsworth is the director of International Rights Advocates and is one of the lawyers who represented Malay and the other John Does in this case.
I started working on the cocoa issues in the late 1990s.
Collingsworth said he sent researchers to West Africa who could speak the language and blend in with the local culture. He wanted them to find out what was really going on.
And they came back with just a devastating report and photographs of the horrific child slavery that was going on in the cocoa sector.
So Collingsworth and others went to Congress with what they'd learned. And Congress introduced a bill that would make it illegal to import chocolate harvested by children. The bill passed, but by that point, the final version was nothing more than a voluntary initiative called the Harkin-Engel Protocol, not a mandatory law.
In other words, compliance was optional, and the voluntary protocol didn't do much to help the problem go away. That's how we get this case.
I asked Collingsworth to walk me through how the child trafficking chain works, how a boy in Mali ends up on a cocoa farm in Ivory Coast, also called Côte d'Ivoire.
The boys go to areas, they'll go to bus stations where there's lots of odd jobs available. The biggest bus station near the border with Côte d'Ivoire is in Sikasso. And I've been there many times, and I've observed this phenomenon many times.
He says that gangs of young teenage boys hang out, hoping to get an odd job, maybe at the tea shop near the bus station or the bike repair shop, the vegetable market.
And they're just wandering around looking for food and something to do that might get them a few pennies.
When Collingsworth last traveled to Mali in November 2019, he went to a bus station and gathered about 20 young boys.
And asked them some questions like, well, what are you here for? What are you doing? Are you in school? None of them were in school or had ever been to school. And then I asked if they'd ever heard about this thing where some guy will promise a job in Côte d'Ivoire, you get a big salary, and then you end up being enslaved there and can't get back. None of them had ever heard even that story. So I told them, don't ever get into a van or a vehicle with someone making that promise. It's not true. You're going to be enslaved.
Collingsworth says the traffickers who do talk the boys into getting in a van take them across the border to a plantation in the middle of nowhere.
They don't have a single penny in their pocket. They speak a different dialect. They don't know anyone, and they're 11 or 12 years old. At that point, they're told, well, actually, you're going to work and we'll feed you. If you don't work, we're not going to feed you and you're going to starve. And that's essentially the transaction. So when they're that young, most of these kids are crying. They're all very
one
upset,
thing about boys, though, they grow up. They get fly. Stronger. Eventually, they stop complying. They leave or escape.
Let's take a moment here to clarify some terms with an expert. Alex Ferguson works for the World Cocoa Foundation. Ferguson explains the different categories of work performed by children as defined by the International Labour Organization.
It doesn't say that all work for children is bad. There is also work where children can help at home and also in the family business.
Yeah, like a family farm with kids pitching in at harvest time, life in a rural area. But the work shouldn't affect their development. If the child is too young or the work too dangerous, that's called child labor.
Child labor is usually defined as something that damages a child by either stopping them from going to school or it exposes them to dangerous work.
Sharp tools, heavy lifting, dangerous machines, and then
there's also forced child labor, and that's really where someone is working against their will.
And finally, what we have here, the worst forms of child labor. The six men in this case claim they were trafficked as young boys as part of the child slave labor trade. Let's listen to a clip from oral arguments at the Supreme Court, conducted by phone last December. Here's Neil Katyal representing Nestle USA and Cargill. The food companies are the defendants.
This court has never accepted the type of claim that the plaintiffs bring here. The claim plaintiffs bring alleges something horrific, that locators in Mali sold them as children to Ivorian farms where overseers forced them to work. The defendants are not the locators, not the overseers, and not the farms. Instead, they are two U.S. corporations. The plaintiffs do not allege that these two owned or operated any farms. And they do not allege that the companies bought anything from farms that use child labor. They claim the companies made decisions in the U.S. and that they had knowledge of child slavery.
On the flip side, Paul Hoffman represented the former trafficked children. Hoffman worked on this case with Collingsworth. We heard from him earlier.
Few international norms are as fundamental as the prohibitions against child slavery and forced labor. Plaintiff's claim fits squarely within the text, history, and purpose of the ATS.
The ATS, Alien Tort Statute. The children, now grown men, brought their claims against Nestle and Cargill under that law. Way back in 1789, the very first Congress passed the Alien Tort Statute, so an old statute contained in only a single sentence. Here's how it reads today.
The district courts shall have original jurisdiction of any civil action by an alien for a tort only, committed in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States.
Let's break that down into three parts. To help us do that is Julian Koo. He teaches international and constitutional law at Hofstra Law School in New York, and he joined a friend of the court brief in support of the companies. First part, the lawsuit must be brought by an alien.
And aliens in that context, a non-U.S. citizen.
In this case, the former child slaves from West Africa. Second part, a tort. A tort is a personal injury. You've been harmed, physically, financially, and you're seeking a remedy, something to fix that harm, usually money damages.
Right. You know, we learned in law school that a tort is a civil wrong. It's not a criminal lawsuit, one in which the government would prosecute the companies. A tort lawsuit is couched in civil law.
This an attempt to give private individuals the right to bring private actions.
And the third part, in violation of the law of nations or a treaty of the United States. Now, the law of nations isn't a bunch of laws codified or recorded in a book or document that you can go read. It's unwritten.
And so the law of nations, we today usually call it customary international law. It's an unwritten set of norms that govern the behavior of governments and their relationship with other governments, or international law.
The worst crimes that most nations agree are illegal. Here's Collingsworth.
That is generally understood to be universally condemned acts. And the list is pretty short. It's slavery, genocide, war crimes, torture, extrajudicial killing.
This case speaks directly to the first wrong in that list.
In the Nestle case, there's no real dispute about that child slavery is a violation of international law. That's widely accepted, that everyone agree that's wrong.
So let's recap here. To bring a claim under the Alien Tort Statute, a non-U.S. citizen must be injured by one of those worst international wrongs.
Let's focus on that second part, Alien Tort Statute, the tort. The wrong alleged in this case is aiding and abetting international human rights violations.
So then it just became a fight over, well, but wait a minute, is aiding and abetting as a corporation effectively just signing contracts with state-owned companies in Ivory Coast, is that a violation of international law of the same level, and everyone would agree would reach the same level of acceptance that no country would object to this type of holding a corporation liable in that instance? And that's where it got really dicey for the plaintiffs, because aiding and abetting is not well-defined under international law.
During oral arguments, Justice Stephen Breyer asked the child slaves lawyer Hoffman about that. What exactly did Nestle and Cargill do that amounted to aiding and abetting? What misconduct can he point to?
What counts as aiding and abetting for purposes of this statute? When I read through your complaint, it seemed to me that all or virtually all of your complaints amount to doing business with these people. They help pay for the farms. And that's about it. And they knowingly do it.
Hoffman, lawyer for the former slaves, said the defendants knew exactly what they were doing. The corporations set up a supply chain where they knowingly purchase cocoa beans from farms that use slave labor.
They know that that's where the cheap beans come from. They have used things like financing and payment.
Yes, that sounds like a business. A business that does business, blinking their eyes or open eyes, with farmers and others throughout the world who use child labor.
To answer that, Hoffman brought up Tony's Chocolonely and small and mid-sized chocolate companies, the chocolate bars we enjoyed earlier. He said these chocolate companies filed friend of the court briefs in support of the former child laborers. Those companies do business without facilitating child labor from Ivory Coast. For example, Mariano and Chrissy DeGeer, the owners of Riversea, some of the chocolate that Jenny and I tasted earlier.
Let's take a detour here before we return to oral argument. let's understand how chocolate is made. I visited Mariano and Chrissy's chocolate shop in Chantilly, Virginia. That same day, a huge shipment of cocoa beans arrived from all over the world. Mariano stands in front of burlap sacks, bursting at the seams with cocoa beans.
India, Vietnam, Tanzania.
He wears sweatpants, a t-shirt, and flip-flops, and has big ideas of how the industry might change. Away from a handful of players distributing chocolate to the whole world, toward a community-oriented approach.
It's always this relationship where the consuming markets are very far away from the producing markets, and that's when you see all these like imbalances that linger from those days where you had lack of information, lack of, you know, exposure, to now people being more transient and more aware.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of time. I am very, very optimistic and hopeful that, you know, things do change. And that's how we promote change, little by little, like acting local but thinking, you know, globally.
Chocolate doesn't start out looking like chocolate. It comes from a fruit called cacao. A cacao pod is about the size of a Nerf football, but with a hard exterior, like a pumpkin. In 2017, Mariano, Chrissy, and their three kids spent the summer in Brazil, where Mariano grew up.
And there was a cacao tree on my cousin's backyard.
So their 11-year-old son climbed the tree, picked a cacao pod, and brought it to Mariano and Chrissy. He asked his mom and dad to make chocolate. Mariano realized, even though he'd grown up around these trees, he had no idea how to do that.
Not a clue. He spent his childhood eating, you guessed it, Nestle chocolate imported from Switzerland.
His cousin didn't know what to do with the cacao pod either.
We were like, how do you make chocolate from that? Nobody knew. You know, we had to look it up on YouTube.
That's Chrissy. Anyway, the family got to work. Crack the cacao pod open, take out the fruit from inside. That's called baba, gooey white stuff. And that baba is the actual fruit that you can eat. But to make chocolate, the family left the baba to ferment. The fruit eats itself up, so to speak, and leaves only its seeds or beans. Put the beans in the sun to dry, take off the husks with a knife, and then grind up the nibs of the beans in a blender with sugar.
We broke a couple blenders and then a food processor, and then you have to temper the chocolate. So the first batch I made, I didn't temper it because I didn't understand that that needed to happen.
Temperature. Heating the ground nibs to melt them and then cooling it. Ta-da! Chocolate.
They were hooked. 3 months later, Mariano and Chrissy decided to start a chocolate company. Today, in Virginia, they receive shipments of dried cocoa beans from farms around the world. They finish the process of bean to bar in their local shop and also make hot chocolate.
Coconut with cream on top?
They do pay a higher price for their beans, work with ethical brokers, visit farms in person, and connect directly with the farmers.
Attentive to labor rights and human rights, it is actually a must that we know where our beans come from and how the fermentation protocols are followed. And if at the end, all those rights are being observed in terms of ensuring that who to work with.
Sometimes they even sail cocoa beans to America, avoiding dirty cargo ships. So this family really goes the extra mile. Well, I hate to leave the chocolate shop, especially because their employee, Bryce, is wrapping bars. But Mary, why don't you take us back to oral arguments?
You know, it's funny, Jenny, that you mentioned ships and cargo because pirates came up at oral argument. You know, we left off with Justice Breyer questioning the attorney for the former slaves. He'd asked whether minimal business practices really aid and abet human rights violations. Well, assuming Nestle's and Cargill's actions did amount to aiding and abetting, Nestle's attorney said the child slaves were harmed halfway across the globe, and the Alien Tort Statute should not apply outside the United States, extraterritorially. But Justice Sonia Sotomayor pointed out that one of the original purposes of the ATS was to address piracy.
We know that under the ATS, the first Congress wanted the ATS to cover piracy. We also know that those who provided assistance to pirates were themselves held liable, whether they committed it on land or the sea, as aiders and abettors. And it boggles my mind to think that the aiding and abetting had to have happened on the sea and not on the land. Because
translation, to argue that Nestle had to travel to Ivory Coast and aid and abet there in order for the alien tort statute to apply didn't make any sense to her, especially when the ATS applied to a United States citizen who aided and abetted a pirate, wherever that assistance occurred, at sea or on American soil.
Another hurdle. The company's lawyer argued the ATS doesn't allow for corporate liability. That, even assuming, once again, that Nestle and Cargill's actions amounted to aiding and abetting. No corporate liability permitted in the law, only individual liability. Justice Elena Kagan seemed suspect.
Could a former child slave bring a suit against an individual slaveholder under the ATS?
Correct.
Okay. And could this same former child slave under the same circumstances bring a suit against 10 slaveholders?
If they met the requirements under the law, yeah, sure. I mean, if there was
okay,
plausible
allegations. Okay, so if you could bring a suit against 10 slaveholders, when those 10 slaveholders form a corporation, why can't you bring a suit against the corporation?
When you go after individuals, you often can go after the true wrongdoers.
Once the true wrongdoers, the traffickers and farm owners, people closest to the wrong being done. Nestle's attorney argued if Congress wanted to hold corporations liable, it could make that happen.
Justice Kagan, we don't doubt that Congress can pass a statute to have corporate liability.
Justice Neil Gorsuch challenged that answer. He pointed to the one sentence, plain language, of the alien tort statute.
I don't see anything in the language of the statute, and I don't believe you pointed to anything that distinguishes between individuals and corporations. And the rationale for the ATS is to ensure that the United States provides a mechanism for aliens to remedy wrongs that would otherwise be held against the United States itself. And on those two lines, on the language and on the rationale, why would we exempt corporations?
The question is not are you exempting corporations, but rather are they included as a subject of the law of nations, which is the text of the ATS. And you talked about the rationale about not letting things go unremedied. There are remedies. You can go after the individual.
Over the years, alien tort statute cases have been all over the map. In the most recent wave of cases, the court has been refining its approach to ATS lawsuits. In 2013, a case came before the court where a Nigerian individual sued a Dutch company for human rights abuses in Nigeria. Here's what the court said in that case.
It said that in order for you to bring a case to the United States under the Alien Tort Statute, they said it must touch and concern the territory of the United States.
The touch and concern test. Legal scholars predicted that would be the test the court would look at to analyze the facts of this case.
Well, back at oral arguments, the justices barely touched on that test. Justice Brett Kavanaugh continued to press on the question of whether corporate liability is appropriate here. Child labor lawyer Hoffman tried to convince the court the statute doesn't distinguish between individuals and corporations.
Foreign law does impose corporate liability, of course, as does U.S. law in many circumstances. But international law and the international tribunals have not seemed to do so.
The alien tort statute is basically a tort statute. It's a civil tort statute. Corporate liability is a general principle of law. It applies in all legal systems. It is applied in our legal system from the beginning. It applied in Britain before we were a nation. In other words, corporate tort liability is the norm. It's not the exception.
Both Nestle and Cargill have programs dedicated to making chocolate from responsibly sourced ingredients, like the Nestle Cocoa Plan and the Cargill Cocoa Promise.
Collingsworth said programs like these do help a few people, but not nearly enough. Here's his take.
They pick a few plantations, a small handful, a small percentage of their total, and they'll clean them up a little bit, and they'll maybe fund a school in the neighborhood and buy the kids some books. And then if someone comes and they want to show them their dog and pony show, they can say, look at this, and we're going to do this everywhere. But they're not. It's a very, very limited program.
I reached out to Nestle and Cargill multiple times. I wanted to speak with someone in their corporate responsibility office about these programs, this case. Crickets. However, Alex Ferguson of the World Cocoa Foundation did speak with me. You heard from him earlier. He's the one who explained the differences between child labor and forced child labor. Well, the World Cocoa Foundation, WCF, works to empower farmers and combat child and forced labor.
So it may be surprising for you to learn that WCF filed a friend of the court brief in support of the companies, Nestle and Cargill. The brief said that to allow a claim like this to succeed under the Alien Tort Statute would encourage lawsuits and discourage industry participation in fighting child labor. Instead, the industry must address the root of the problem, poverty. Here's Ferguson.
Child labor is associated with poverty. If you're poor, you won't be able to hire a laborer to work on your farm. And then your children could end up doing that work.
He said helping farmers turn their farms into prosperous businesses is no easy fix and requires multiple changes.
So we run training programs on increasing productivity so that they grow more cocoa on less land. Another area is crop diversification. Then they can also earn income from other crops that they sell or indeed feed themselves from those crops. We're also promoting village savings and loan associations. So the issue really is one of finding ways to help the farmer and his family improve their income, because that's going to, you know, once they have more disposable income, that is, they have more choice.
In support of the other side, the former child slaves, Tom and Monica Rogan. They joined the Friend of the Court brief for chocolate companies that use ethically sourced beans. About 10 years ago, they MacGyvered their first batch of chocolate in their kitchen.
We just got really interested in it and started doing it as a hobby, as Monica was saying.
Yeah.
And that grew over time. And then my company got bought in 2010. And at that point, people have been telling us, hey, you guys make amazing chocolate. Yeah. You should sell this.
They knew chocolate comes from a fruit. Fruit has to be harvested. Who was doing that?
And we learned that there were a lot of issues with the cacao supply chain.
They wanted to compensate farmers fairly.
We go down to these farms so we can see their process and know what they're doing and understand it. And also, we, by visiting with the farmers, talking to the farmers, we can see what their labor practices are on the farms. We can examine their books in person. Because Monica's fluent in Spanish too, we have direct conversations with farmers, with workers, so we can get things firsthand.
So this ability to have this direct connection and to know the hands that it all passes through to when it gets to us, this traceability, this is important to us. Seeing all the benefits that go along with that, from a social impact, economic impact on their level, to like a flavor impact on our level.
But how realistic is this on a big scale?
We think it's not only is it possible, but it's actually more doable than on a small scale. When a consumer is paying $1 or $2 for a chocolate bar, you know, that is underpriced. There's an artificially low price. So there is room for that number to go up.
A Good Now Farms chocolate bar, $12. River Sea, $6 to $8. Those prices may not be realistic for the average consumer. But Rogan says ethical sourcing is still possible, even at the lower prices consumers pay.
These companies are extremely profitable. So there are many different approaches these companies could take to be more ethical and be more sustainable. And there's no one size fits all.
The companies have the deep pockets to have a person or team on the ground on the farms monitoring, Rogan says.
Well, the lower district and appellate courts bandied this case back and forth for years. The Ninth Circuit had found that the claims, as pleaded, could proceed under the ATS. Here, the Supreme Court reversed that decision, but it remanded the case for further proceedings. In doing so, it tinkered with the proper scope of ATS claims again. Again, it refined the way courts should look at lawsuits filed under the Alien Tort Statute. In the end, the court applied its ruling from a 2016 case, RJR Nabisco versus the European Community. That case also involved a question about a statute's extraterritorial application, but the case had nothing to do with the alien tort statute. It centered on a different one. Still, the court said that the RJR ruling applies to the question here. When can a federal statute be applied outside the United States? Law professor Ku summarizes the test from RJR.
And the general rule is that unless it clearly states that it's meant to apply outside the United States, the court should not do so unless the focus of the statute and the conduct in a particular case is such that it would make sense to assert jurisdiction. So there's essentially new precedent that came in. Now, it was not at the time understood necessarily to apply to the alien tort statute, but now the court tells us it is.
The decision came down 8-1 in favor of Nestle and Cargill in the sense that the new test is harder to meet. Justice Clarence Thomas authored the opinion. Justice Samuel Alito filed a dissent. Eight justices agreed on the extraterritoriality question. The alien tort statute doesn't expressly state it applies outside the United States, so the presumption is it doesn't. The court said the ATS covers certain misconduct, and that misconduct must occur in the United States. Here, the allegations didn't meet that requirement. Again, Professor Ku.
There's no misconduct in the United States. There's just typical corporate conduct. We're going to go buy some cocoa from this farm. There's no evidence that it was part of a plan to use forced labor or anything like that. This is just, we're buying cocoa from this farm. Now, they probably shouldn't have. They probably should have investigated more. They should have done things. But none of that is the misconduct at issue here that would rise to the level of violation of law of nations.
The focus of the ATS is violation of the law of nations. So it's now back to the lower courts to figure out if the former child slaves can amend their complaint to show the misconduct or violations of the law of nations occurred in the United States. Merely making contracts and decisions about buying cocoa isn't enough. As far as whether a corporation can be sued under the ATS, five justices said yes, we see no reason why not. But the majority opinion did not officially reach that issue.
Terry Collingsworth says he and the former child slaves aren't giving up. In the time since they filed this lawsuit 15 years ago, Congress has passed the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. A mouthful, but named after the Christian and British politician who dedicated his life to abolishing slavery.
It creates a private cause of action for victims of trafficking and forced labor. In February, eight former child slaves sued Nestle, Cargill, and others under that act. Collingsworth.
But I hope that the companies received a message loud and clear that we're just never going away. I mean, we're going to continue to pursue this as long as we're breathing air.
Before we end today, listen to one last clip from oral arguments. A comment from Justice Breyer.
Well, unfortunately, child labor, it's terrible, but it exists throughout the world in many, many places. And if we take this as the norm, and I don't know, but I have concern that treating this allegation, the sixth that you make here, as aiding and abetting falling within that term for purposes of this statute, could have very, very significant effects. I'm just saying I'm worried about that.
The problem doesn't start and stop with chocolate. One amicus brief pointed out child labor problems exist in clothing, carpeting, sugarcane, shrimp. You get the idea.
Yeah, not to mention the mining of materials that goes on with our smartphones and computers that we use to create this very program.
Forgoing industrial chocolate is one thing. Technology is harder to walk away from. Collingsworth focuses his legal efforts in that area as well. I asked him what he does.
Well, I didn't throw my iPhone away or my Dell laptop when I sued these companies for using forced child labor to harvest cobalt. I don't expect anyone else to either. And this is such an essential thing now. So what I ask consumers to do is, again, contact the companies and tell them, I won't be upgrading, I won't be buying any more of your stuff until you fix this. We have the right as consumers to be sure that you're not injuring or killing children in the manufacture of these products.
Tom and Monica Rogan contemplate the difficulty and importance of not only corporate responsibility, but consumer responsibility.
How do you get people to take action, and what should they do? And oftentimes the response is, well, just stop buying that chocolate. And
that isn't the answer, because these farmers still need these companies to buy the cacao. They're the ones who are there now. So it's more about the harder choice of you need to engage, you need to contact the company, you need to make your voice heard.
As we open our eyes to labor practices, we'll begin to see global inequalities all around us. So much work to be done. It can be paralyzing. But
instead of being overwhelmed and saying, I can't do anything, there are things that we can do better. And so let's just chip away at it, one step at a time. And you know what better way to do that than eating delicious chocolate?
Good idea. We don't need to quit chocolate, but we can be discerning.
How's your belly doing? Should we keep going? I have a high tolerance for sugar.
Legal Docket is produced by the creative team at World Radio. I'm Jenny Ruff.
And I'm Mary Reichard. We're the hosts each week. Our script editors are Nick Eicher and Paul Butler, who's also our producer. Technical engineer is Rich Rosel.
Thanks go to Terry Collingsworth, Chrissy and Mariano DeGeer, Alex Ferguson, Julian Koo, and Monica and Tom Rogan. Source material in this episode included TEDx and oral arguments from SupremeCourt.gov.
We've been so encouraged by the ratings and reviews you've left for us. We're a small team competing with some really big players. Your reviews help others to find us and helps get the word out about this very special podcast.
Support for the Legal Docket podcast comes from listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.